This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. We begin this edition of Ozarks at Large with a report about a new invention that may revolutionize how poultry litter is spread on Ozarks pastures as fertilizer.
As Jacqueline Froelich reports, the device may quell embattled interests that have sought to limit poultry wasteland application because it pollutes area streams and lakes.
With mandates to limit land application of poultry waste, in both the White and Illinois River watersheds, farmers have been forced to stockpile tons of poultry litter, a mixture of rice hulls and wood shavings and chicken manure, in covered sheds. Only at scheduled intervals, depending on the weather, are they allowed to spread it on top of cattle pastures. Most Ozark poultry farmers also raise beef cattle as a sideline because the waste litter provides excellent nutrients to the soil. To deal with the litter glut, industrialists have pitched building a giant incinerator here to burn millions of tons of it to generate electricity. Certain poultry producers are testing small furnaces burning litter to heat their chicken houses, and yet others are looking at ways to market the waste as a commercial soil amendment. But Daniel Pote has found a solution for poultry litter application.
If we could place it under the surface in very shallow trenches and cover it up, and when I say shallow, I'm talking only about 3 inches deep. It's right down in the root zone of the crop, but it's not exposed to the atmosphere.
Daniel Pote is an agronomist, a soil scientist with USDA's research service based at the Dale Bumper Small Farms Research Center in Boonville. He and his colleague, Stephen Holler, a research technician at the center, have developed alternatives to conventional use of poultry litter as a crop fertilizer.
It's been used as a nutrient source primarily in this part of the country on pastures, because that's beef pastures are the main kind of agriculture we have besides poultry. The problem with the way we've had to spread it on pastures is it always has to be put on the surface. You can't just plow up a pasture. Of course, you'd mess up your crop. So by putting it on top, what we do is leave the nutrients completely exposed to the atmosphere. There's two major problems that come from this. One is the nitrogen would tend to simply evaporate into the atmosphere as ammonia. In some cases, under certain atmospheric conditions, you might lose as much as 50% of your nitrogen before the crop would ever have a chance to see it. The other thing that can happen is when it's lying on the surface of the ground, if there's a major runoff event, a big rainstorm of some type, a lot of the nutrients just wash off the field into nearby streams and lakes. And of course, nutrients in a lake can cause a problem because there they fertilize an algae crop, which can cause serious water quality problems. So what we're trying to do is help the farmers by providing an option that they can hopefully make better use of those nutrients, use them more efficiently by keeping them on the field, keeping them where the crop can use them instead of losing them into the streams.
4 years ago, they started fashioning a farm implement poultry litter subsurface applicator, nicknamed the Subsurfer.
Dr. Tom Way down at the National Soil Dynamics Lab in Auburn, Alabama, had developed a prototype machine that had only one single shank, that is, it would only make one trench at a time. And he was using this for row crops to put litter under the surface. So we asked him if he could come up to Arkansas and let us try it on pastures. And he was willing to do that. We worked with him. We did some research with that machine and found that mechanical subsurface application provided the same benefits that manual application showed us. That is, it would prevent more than 90% of the nutrient loss and runoff in the first rain event after a litter application. And it would also prevent the nitrogen from volatilizing as ammonia.
And that's a big deal for neighbors living near poultry farms. The litter that's typically spread on pastures stinks for days and may impair air quality. Typically 2.5 tons of litter are surface applied per acre, but the Subsurfer would apply half that for the same amount of productivity, depending on the soil chemistry. And some crop yields may even increase, Pote said. The 4-ton tractor-drawn implement holds a large litter hopper.
And we designed a machine then with a 12-inch row spacing that's fixed at that width. And we can put 5 tons of litter into this machine at a time. It does not require any kind of pre-grinding or pre-treatment. We can load it right out of the house. It does require that the litter be fairly dry so that it's not a sticky consistency. It makes parallel trenches across the soil surface that are about 3 inches deep and 2 inches wide. We fill those trenches almost to the top with litter and then cover it over with soil so that there are just narrow bands of litter under the surface down in the root zone of the grass. We often get a question about will this work in rocky soils, and the answer is yes. We have tested some in the past that used sliding blades that tended to pull rocks up a bit, but the one we have now is a double disc opener. It's really very similar to no-till technology for planters in the way it puts litter under the surface. It simply has a leading coulter that slices the soil, a double disc opener that creates the trench opening, and then an auger system inside the machine actually feeds the litter, grinds it as it moves it forward, and drops it down through some chutes so that it falls right between those double discs and right into the trench. And then a closing wheel follows behind and covers it up.
Along with no-till corn and cotton crops in Mississippi and Kentucky, the device has been tested on Bermuda and fescue plots in the Ozarks. The litter was both spread and injected by the subsurfer. Simulated rain was applied, and Pote found less than 10% of the nutrients leached out in the trenched plot. Plus, the injected litter remained more fixed, Pote said.
We can get more production from the same amount of litter. We're no longer losing a good portion of the nitrogen when we apply it. And we also keep the nitrogen and phosphorus in a much more favorable ratio compared to what plants require. Normally, litter has far more phosphorus compared to the nitrogen than what a plant needs. And that excess phosphorus tends to accumulate and build up in the soil. And you may have heard stories in the news about the accumulation of soil phosphorus levels and high soil test P. Well, this would tend to slow down that process because it allows the nitrogen to remain in the litter and keep the ratio a bit more favorable for crops. Now, there would still be some phosphorus accumulation, but it would slow that process down quite a bit.
Pote and Haller are building new prototypes of the subsurfer, while the USDA Agricultural Research Service, for which Pote works, has secured a U.S. patent on the implement and are seeking an international patent. They've also found a manufacturer.
Yes, Barron & Brothers International, a company out of Cornelia, Georgia, has applied for a license to manufacture this and has reached an agreement with USDA for the manufacturing rights. So they will be producing these newer prototypes that are coming out now, and they are hoping that if everything with the field testing goes well, that they may be ready for commercial production within about a year.
Poultry scientists working in other high poultry production watersheds to prevent litter pollution have shown a lot of interest in the subsurfer.
So 5 universities in the states of Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, New York, and Pennsylvania have all obtained grant funding to get advanced prototypes that they can use for doing more field testing on farmers' fields there in that area. And right now we're in the process of getting those new prototypes built. So hopefully they'll be able to test them this spring and summer, and we'll get some further information on widespread use on a lot of acreage.
But funding for this first prototype has come from inside Arkansas.
We were in need of some funding to build that first big prototype, and so I need to thank the Arkansas Natural Resources Commission. They put up approximately 90% of the funding that we needed to build this first prototype and help us really move this technology forward.
And for good reason. Since 1990, the Arkansas Natural Resources Commission has served as the lead agency for the Arkansas Non-Point Source Pollution Management Program. One of its primary concerns? Mitigating the ecological impact from animal agriculture runoff. And for good reason. Since 1990, the Arkansas Natural Resources Commission has served as the lead agency for the Arkansas Non-Point Source Pollution Management Program. One of its primary concerns? Mitigating the ecological impact from animal agriculture runoff. And the Oklahoma Attorney General-elect, Scott Pruitt, has reportedly said he intends to review the pending lawsuit as soon as he takes office next year. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. Another story that's connected to the soil now. It's a story about a ghost town. And with me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Ithi Agnihotri-Madulker.
Hello. Hello, Kyle.
This is a story about a town not too far away from here, correct?
Yes, it's about Pitcher, Oklahoma, that's 2 hours away from Fayetteville. Now, this town is very unique because it is a modern-day ghost town.
For environmental reasons, it has been practically abandoned, right?
Yes. There was lead mining conducted in the town for a very, very long time, and what happened was lead got into the soil, it polluted the water, it polluted the air, and the government deemed it absolutely unsuitable for people to live in. So they asked everybody to move out, and now it's abandoned.
You recently talked to a pair of photographers who have mm-hmm. captured some images. You talked to them in the Harold and Blanche Cox studio. Mm-hmm. Who are they and why are they connected to Pitcher?
Well, I spoke with photographers Philip Thomas and Jason Hudson. Now, what happened was Philip Thomas is very much interested in filming all these ghost towns. He went to Dogpatch USA earlier this year, and then a friend of his told him about Pitcher, Oklahoma, and he told Jason Hudson about Pitcher, Oklahoma, and that's how they got together, and they visited the town to film these images, and they're remarkable.
And where did you first see the pictures?
Where else but Facebook.
The way I knew of Pitcher when he said the word Pitcher is that the tornado of 2008 came through and just basically wiped out 3/4 of the town. That's how I knew it. I didn't know about its mining history. In World War One, they produced 50% of all lead for World War One came out of Pitcher. So all the bullets and everything they used in military all came out of that mine. It's just rich with lead. We didn't know back in the 1930s and 40s or whatever that lead was bad for you. So when it's piled up in your city, it can be bad. I think it's bad for kids to have prolonged exposure to that. So the history is they were a mining town. Then the government decided they would shut down the mine. I believe they stopped mining in the 60s. And then it just kind of deteriorated from there. And then 2008, the tornado kind of helped the town along in its movement to go away. And about September 2009, they voted. I think there were 60 residents there in 2009. There was several thousand just a couple years earlier. And they voted to dismantle the town and move on. They kind of had a party the last day, a little get-together for the town. And I think in May 2009, the last graduating class of 11 people graduated high school there. And that was it. After that, the school was locked up.
So, Philip, you were the one who came up with the idea of visiting Pitcher. So had you already been to Pitcher before the final shoot?
Well, I went and shot pictures once. I had no idea. I'd seen a few pictures on the internet of it and read just a little bit about it, but I had no idea what to expect. And so the first time I went, I was just floored because, you know, I think people living around here in civilization can't get their mind around what it's like to stand in a neighborhood that's completely vacant, but there's houses and there's unmowed grass and there's like, you know, graffiti on the houses, which we came to realize it was all like government stuff. Like they'd gone into the homes and figured out, you know, okay, this area's cleaned out so they'd mark it and whatnot. But very apocalyptic and surreal and really cool.
I think the neatest thing is you're watching a ghost town develop, because if you go to a ghost town like in the Nevada desert or something that's been there 100 years, obviously you don't expect it. You expect to be vacant and nobody's there and nobody's been there. But this is like you went to sleep and you woke up on a normal day and you went outside to go to work and nobody's there. The school was in perfect condition. They could have class tomorrow. The asphalt on the track was newly paved. It could have a track meet today. But at 10 a.m. on a Monday morning, there's no students there. It's just so strange to just like, you feel like you're in a movie because you just woke up and everybody's gone. And it's a surreal feeling.
So I have to ask, did you have to get any special permission to shoot the images, or did you just go there and start?
Basically, it's open. there were some, look like, I think they've kind of turned it back over to an Indian reservation, and it looked like there was one official from that, but they didn't bother us. We saw an ambulance go by that said Pitcher Ambulance, but it wasn't used for that purpose. They were hauling wood over to one of the school buildings to put, just board up the windows, basically. So it's weird because there's no fire protection, there's no ambulance, there's no police. It's basically you're there. I mean, we saw a county sheriff drive through once, I think. Probably just going somewhere else, but there's no municipality at all. There's no government. Nobody's really cared. I wouldn't know who to ask permission of. There's really nobody there to ask. A lot of the buildings were marked off and said keep out, and we actually obeyed that. We didn't trespass. The buildings we went through were not marked, and they were just standing open. We didn't tear down any doors or break any windows. I really want to get into the high school, though, just to see what it, because it was so intact and just to show that there was no people there. But it was pretty well secured, locked up. So,
is there anything there?
I would say there's four people max. I mean, we saw evidence of two houses that had a mowed yard and a car. And one person was sitting on their porch reading, and they kind of looked up. They had a hoodie on, and they kind of looked up. And then just look back down at their book. They didn't pay any attention to us. So,
there's a pharmacy that's still in operation, but the people that work there don't live in Pitcher. And they kind of explained that they kept the pharmacy open because people that used to live in Pitcher would come back to get their medications. And all the other offices and the bank and post office and whatnot have been relocated to other towns. But this pharmacy, for some reason, is still open, and we stopped in to ask for directions to the sinkhole. but we just kind of asked them a few questions, and yeah, none of them live there. But that's the only actual business that's operating in the town.
Did you wear any protective gear? Because the air is probably very toxic.
We decided that prolonged exposure is what's bad for the residents, so that we would only be there for that one afternoon, and basically most part of a one day. So I kind of felt a little funny throughout the day, though. I kind of got a little something in my chest and a slight headache, but it could also be psychological. But I thought I felt something, and I did climb up. When they took out the mines, there's just what they call chat. It's just piled up everywhere because they didn't know what to do with it, so they just piled it all over the town. But that's full of lead, and that stuff gets in the air, and you breathe it, and it's real bad for you. And I got the bright idea that I wanted Philip to take a picture of me on top of one of the piles, so I got climbed up, and then it got real soft, and it got up to my knees, and I was kind of climbing in it, and that's when I started to feel like I was inhaling it a little bit. And I couldn't imagine living there, though. It's unsafe for humans, and the government offered everybody, I think I read, $55 a square foot to move out. They said, this is not habitable. The water's bad. The air's bad. There's no reason to be here. You need to leave. And yeah, I can see why.
So did you guys plan it from beforehand, or did you just go in there and started taking pictures randomly?
We didn't talk. I mean, we didn't strategically look at maps and figure out where we wanted to go. We were less residential and more like commercial properties in the downtown area. One of the scariest things was we're walking down an alley and kind of went into this door, and it looked like a home. You know, there was carpet on the walls and mirrors on the walls and these signs in the kind of the parlor area for these rooms off to the side that said stateroom A and B and C. And then we thought, well, maybe it was a church because there's, you know, some divider walls that can be moved. And so we went outside and kind of looked at the outside. And that's when we realized we were in the funeral home for the town.
I noticed three garage doors on the front of the building. I said, a church wouldn't have three garage doors. I bet that's for the hearses and things.
Yeah.
So, of course, we went back in.
Yeah.
Pitch dark. Didn't have a flashlight. Used our cell phone light to guide us through the garage. And then the back room said, safety precautions needed in this room. And I realized that's probably where they worked on bodies. And so we went in there and looked around a little bit and then decided to go ahead and leave.
And I was, it was very, very, very scary. But some of the other places we went into, there was just junk. Jason picked up a newspaper out off a pile and it was
coincidentally, it was September 11th, 2001. It said, we're attacked. It was a special afternoon edition. I was like, what are the odds that this would be actually an important piece of, you know, literature of journalism right there, just on this pile, just deteriorating. And I don't know, that just to see people's personal artifacts left behind, you know, after the tornado, I guess people left and just didn't come back. And there's, like I say, drapes in the window. There's books, there's beds, and everything's in good condition. few months of cleanup, the whole town could be back in business, but it's just too toxic and too tainted to live there, unfortunately.
Were you ever tempted to pick one of these things up to bring back as a souvenir, you know, a piece of history almost?
It is history. I really wanted that newspaper, but I just decided to leave it. It wasn't ours for the taking. I'm sure somebody else will come along and take it, but I decided not to. We decided just to take pictures and just kind of leave everything else. But
and I think as photographers too, like you go into a place like that and the way that you capture stuff and just what you experience. I know for me and for Jason, it just, you have a respect for the place. You want to capture it. You want to experience it. You want to sort of relive it and, you know, figure out some of the history and just kind of absorb that. But you don't want to ruin it.
Mm-hmm. Did it feel like that you're trespassing on people's tragedies?
Good question. There were some homes marked no trespassing, and we obeyed those signs. The ones we went to, the doors were already standing open. The windows were out. The breeze was blowing through it. And we, most of the actual homes where people lived, we just kind of stuck our head in the door or looked through the window. It was mostly the commercial buildings and churches that we walked through. It's just interesting to watch a ghost town develop, where normally I've been to a lot of places out in the desert near Las Vegas with a ghost town, and there's just remnants of stone and rubble, and that's just what it is. But yeah, we're actually watching history unfold and watching what happens to a city if there were no people. We're watching nature take over. Watching the plant life grow up the walls and trees grow into homes and water tear down buildings and things. And every time a storm comes through, it's going to do a little bit more damage to the already vulnerable building. So, yeah.
And it is sad, really sad. And, you know, a lot of people, for them, it's not a ghost town. It's their town, you know, watching their town deteriorate. And, you know, it's sad, but I think it's important that, you know, people feel the weight of a situation like that. You know, not everyone has the experience. And so I think in some way, shape or form, it's good to sort of remind the people that this is Pitcher and this happened, and, you know, be thankful and be grateful for what you have.
What did the place sound like?
The wind there in the plains is just ferocious. It just doesn't stop, and there's nothing to stop the wind. So you have this constant whistle of wind, but then that wind is also going through every broken window in town, which creates an eerie sound. And then, like I say, the curtains have not deteriorated. They're still there. So the drapes are flapping in the breeze. And it's just constantly you're looking around your shoulder like, what's that? What's that? What's that? And it's usually sheet metal banging off a roof or off the side of a building. Or I didn't really see any wildlife through there. I didn't see any dogs running around. There was one house we were in where I started hearing footsteps in the back, and it's a good thing I don't believe in ghosts, but I didn't know if it was a dog or one of the few locals messing with us, but it really sounded like someone walking, and we just very quietly turned around and went back outside, and I never saw anybody, so I don't know what that was. But
thank goodness that wasn't in the funeral home, because that really would have been.
Yeah, we would have been to our car, I guess, and back to Arkansas.
So which of your images are your favorites?
Goodness.
Both of you.
It's hard to narrow down one. There's an old church there that just has the look of a horror movie, a still from a horror film or something, just old, decomposed. I like that kind of look, and it's just a beautiful building, and you could tell it was a beautiful building back in its day and probably where all the townspeople went to church. It was probably the original church. And to me, that scene was really neat, especially how it was so vacant around it. It was probably a meeting place at one time, but now it's just nothing. I like that a lot. And then just the little details of the newspaper and people's eyeglasses and CDs or albums or picture albums or whatever. They're just all those little details that people touched, and it belongs to somebody.
Yeah, I would say from this trip, probably the first couple of images that I shot of the school, I really wanted to get into the school, you know, just walking around there trying to figure out and trying to envision what the students and the parents of the students were feeling, you know, being torn apart like that, having to make a decision whether to close the school or not. And I mean, probably in the best interest of the town to do that, but you can't ignore the relationships and the childhood memories and that sort of stuff. And so just feeling the weight of that and just, you know, walking around the school and just kind of absorbing everything. Those are probably some of my favorite images.
As photographers, do you seek to capture the beauty of the place or the horror?
I would say the reality of the place. I mean, it's subjective. There's definitely, amidst all the rubble and the clutter and the destroyed decay stuff, there's, you know, there's images of hope. Definitely there's some good memories. There's but there's also, you know, sad stuff. And I think just capture what I saw and just put it out there for people.
I thought our pictures complement each other. When I was looking through Philip's portfolio of it, he did a good job of looking at little details, little things that are there, little objects and found whatnot, like finding the American flag in the reflection. I didn't see that, so that was good, and a lot of layers in that picture. But I kind of thought from a more wider angle standpoint, where I kind of captured a lot of buildings in one picture to show the emptiness of the place. I think that's what I was trying to capture, just the void of nothing. But as far as the city, I have video in my camera, and I thought about switching over to video several times, but then I thought, well, everything's stationary, and there's really no sound except a little bit of wind, so I just decided to keep with the still pictures this time. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah.
That's Ozarks at Large's Ithi Agnihotri-Madulkar talking with photographers Philip Thomas and Jason Hudson in the Herald and Blanchcock News studio recently. And there are places where people can see the pictures?
Yes, absolutely. You can visit hudsonphotos.blogspot.com. That is Jason Hudson's blog. And you can visit the Novo Studio page on Facebook.
And we'll have those links on ozarksatlarge.com.
Absolutely.
One more question. Would you be interested in going to Pitcher?
I would be very, very interested. Would you, Kyle?
I don't know.
Why?
Well, I mean, it's not the healthiest of places, and
that's right.
I don't know. There seems, I don't know.
Maybe
it
we
seems
can
a little
plan
scary.
A trip together?
Perhaps.
Okay.
All right.
So the news team of Ozarks at Large.
There you go.
Good.
Good story. Thank you, Ithi.
Thank you.
There is another town about to be abandoned, though this one is fictional. For the past 10 years, audiences in Northwest Arkansas have been laughing at and with the residents of DuPont, Mississippi. The shrinking fictional town has been fodder for playwright Mark Landon Smith of Fayetteville and the theater company Ceramic Cow Productions. Beginning Wednesday, the production of I'm Dreaming of a DuPont Christmas will be on stage at the UARC Ballroom on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. But it will be the last time DuPont is brought to a local stage, at least for a while. Mark Landon Smith, the man who has created the DuPont series, says it's time for the town to rest.
Well, I think it's just like with anything else, like with when MASH went off the air, and it's or the Golden Girls, or any, you know, Will and Grace, any number of series going out on top, and not wanting to let the piece start to lose its
atrophy.
Lose that specialness that people have come to expect and enjoy each year.
So. Have you stopped enjoying doing it?
No, we still love doing it. We are just looking forward to exploring some different genres and some other different avenues too, and different mediums. We produced a because we've been producing almost exclusively with DuPont for 10 years.
And when you say we, you mean Ceramic Cow.
Ceramic Cow and my co-producer and co-business partner, Julie Gable. And we've been doing, like I said, DuPont almost exclusively for a decade. And then last year we produced a show called Radio Dazed for Ceramic Cow for the October for Halloween season. And it was wildly successful. And it really kind of excited us that, oh, yes, we can do something other than just DuPont. You know, we can do some other things. So we're excited about exploring those possibilities.
Well, let's talk about this DuPont, final DuPont. It's another Christmas at DuPont.
It is another Christmas in DuPont. And those who are not familiar with DuPont, it is a small town in the south, somewhere in the middle of nowhere, where the population keeps descending each year. So now they're down to like 740 people in the entire town. And there's this group of people who have been born, raised, lived, and will more than likely die in DuPont, and they've known each other their entire lives. So their entire social network is based upon the First United Congregational Shepherd of the Flock Baptistical Church. That's all they've got in this small town. So it's just about small-town relationships and the holiday season and how that's – to me, it's just, you know, comedy just waiting to happen. So
Now, how similar is this staging of a DuPont Christmas to previous ones?
It is different, but there are some same elements. We've kept the things that people are familiar with and that people have come to expect and enjoy so much, but we've also added new elements. We've written out some characters. We've added some characters. So there is a lot different, but there's a lot of that is the same and familiar.
If someone's never seen the residents of DuPont, they're going to be fine when they sit down?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It doesn't build upon the previous versions of it. It does stand on its own. So it's a great, great, fun way to bring in the holiday season.
And when you say DuPont is going to go to rest for a while, could be years?
Well, we have absolutely no idea. We haven't really thought about that. It could be kind of like Cher, where we're going on retirement every other year, and it's going to be our last year. We may go back up in a couple of months. I don't know. But we think we're going to let it rest for a while.
Any ideas what might be coming then in 2011?
Well, we've been doing fun bags for the past year.
And the improv group
under Ceramic Cow, and we do short form comedy. And our last show, which was December 4th, we had about 150, 175 people there, which was just overwhelming to us. And we loved it. And so we're really going to start working more with fun bags and expanding the format. And we're talking about doing a YouTube series and filming a lot of sketch comedy and that sort of thing, too. So and some radio we've talked about, too. So,
yes.
Yeah.
All right.
So we've got all kinds of options.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Mark Landon Smith created the DuPont series of plays and is a founding member of Ceramic Cow Productions. Their production of I'm Dreaming of a DuPont Christmas opens Wednesday night at the UARC Ballroom on Dixon Street in Fayetteville and runs through Saturday. For more information, ceramiccowproductions.com.
And they called it puppy love.
Singer and actor Donny Osmond was born on this date in 1957 in Utah. The entertainer began performing with his older siblings as part of the Osmond Brothers when he was a young child. In 1962, the Osmond Brothers appeared on The Andy Williams Show, which introduced the group to a national audience. The group had several hits, including One Bad Apple, Down by the Lazy River, and Crazy River. Also pursuing a solo career, Osmond had a pop hit with Go Away, Little Girl in 1971. Some of his commercially successful songs include Too Young and Puppy Love. Around the mid-70s, Donny began performing with his younger sister Marie. They were featured in their own television special in 1975, which proved to be quite popular with viewers. This led to the siblings getting their own variety show the following year. In 1982, Osmond made his Broadway debut in Little Johnny Jones, but this musical revival quickly closed. It was not until the late 1980s that Osmond was able to revive his music career. Released in 1989, Soldier of Love reached the number 2 slot on the Billboard Pop charts. In 1998, Osmond returned to television with his sister to co-host a daytime talk show, which ran for just 2 seasons. The following year, he became a best-selling author with the publication of Life is Just What You Make It, My Life So Far. He then became a game show host for Pyramid. The 2003 release of the Osmond's Greatest Hits collection led to the Osmond Brothers returning to the pop charts in the United Kingdom. Spurred on by the album's success, the brothers later regrouped and did a UK tour. That same year, Donny and other members of the Osmond family received a star on Hollywood's Walk of Fame. Osmond has continued performing with his brothers and as a solo act. In 2006, he returned to Broadway to appear as Gaston in the musical Beauty and the Beast. Montgomery County, Arkansas, was founded on this date in 1842. It was named after Richard Montgomery, a general in the Revolutionary War, and has its county seat as Mount Ida. Montgomery County is noted for its quartz crystal deposits, the rugged beauty of the Ouachita Mountains, and its sparkling clear waters. On this date in 1907, Christmas seals went on sale for the first time at the Wilmington, Delaware Post Office. The proceeds went to fight tuberculosis. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
It is beginning to sound a lot more like Christmas. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Megan Martin. She's the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers. For the last several days when you and I have been visiting, it's been Christmas pageant, Christmas play, Christmas
dance. Oh, it's
dance.
Still Christmas.
Okay.
It's still Christmas. If you're still looking for your ho, 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 here are today's suggestions. Fort Smith Little Theater is doing a Laura Ingalls Wilder Christmas, Tales from the Holiday on the Prairie. It starts tonight at 8 o'clock and runs through December 11th. Admission is $5.
Take the whole family.
Absolutely. And tonight, Kathy Mattea, who won a Grammy for her collection of Christmas songs called Good News, is at the Walton Arts Center for a performance at 7 o'clock. The show's called Songs of the Season, and tickets start at $28.
WaltonArtsCenter.org?
Yes.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is P.J. Hrabowski. P.J. is the music director at KUAF and the host of Film Score Friday, heard every Friday. P.J., welcome back.
Thank you, Kyle.
You pick one movie score and one movie to kind of concentrate on these Thursday visits. That gives us a preview of your Friday show. What is that soundtrack and film today?
Well, this time we're going back to 1940 and a movie called Rebecca. Now, Rebecca... Well, first off, the most famous line in the movie is right at the beginning, and it's, "Last night I dreamt I went to Mandalay again." And that's Rebecca's haunting opening line that conjures up the entirety of Alfred Hitchcock's romantic, suspenseful, and elegant film. A young woman, played by Joan Fontaine, mm-hmm. believes her every dream has come true when her whirlwind romance with dashing Maxim de Winter results in marriage. But she soon realizes that Rebecca, the late first Mrs. de Winter, haunts both the temperamental, brooding Maxim and the de Winter mansion.
This is a Hitchcock movie, after all.
I know. And the mansion's called Mandalay. Now, in order for Maxim and the new Mrs. de Winter to have a future, Rebecca's spell must be broken and the mystery of her violent death unraveled. Now, this is the first collaboration between producer David O. Selznick and Hitchcock. Now, Rebecca was adapted from Daphne du Maurier's popular novel, and it won the 1940 Academy Award for Best Picture and Cinematography. Now, Hitchcock hasn't been able to do that well since, and the thing that's kind of ironic is it's the only film directed by the master of suspense to win a Best Picture Oscar, and it would be a gothic melodrama.
And it's certainly, if you were to go out on the street and ask people to name 5, 10, 15 Hitchcock films, most would not include Rebecca.
I know, and it's funny because it wasn't until I started doing Film Score Friday that I even realized that Rebecca was a Hitchcock movie. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was kind of funny. You know, you still have this this tension in the movie, Rebecca, but it's still about as far from his comfortable thriller territory as Hitchcock has ever strayed. And in this movie, he illustrates, though, the ability of crafting not only psychological terror, but drama and romance as well. And, you know, it was the first Hitchcock movie made in the U.S.
Mm, the others had been in his native Britain.
Right. Now, when asked which of the 144 films that Franz Waxman would score in Hollywood, his favorite, Waxman always replies, Rebecca.
So here you have the only Hitchcock that ever won Best Picture. You have mm-hmm. Franz Waxman's favorite score.
Right.
And it's a movie that it hasn't been forgotten, but it certainly isn't part of the public consciousness anymore.
No, and I tend to get it mixed up with a couple of the other old gothic movies. I'm going, now, is this the part where we find out about the crazy woman locked in the back room? Oh, no, that's not that one. You know, so, yeah, it gets a little confusing. But when you think of Franz Waxman, you know, when you think of Hitchcock, who do you think of as usually
Bernard Herrmann?
Right. But Waxman did 4 Hitchcock movies. Also did Paradine Case, Suspicion, and Rear Window. Hmm. Which in Rear Window there wasn't a lot of music,
right.
But there was some. Now, Waxman's score for Rebecca was a milestone. Its impact on his musical style was so profound that throughout the rest of his 26-year career in Hollywood, he would compose music for at least a half a dozen more films with that similar gothic background. Now, it was a very popular film score in the early 40s. It was even made into a suite that's been played often by symphony orchestras.
Hmm.
I know.
Called the Rebecca Suite?
Yes. Yeah. In his book, The Composer in Hollywood, Christopher Palmer discusses Rebecca. She's never seen, for she's dead. The only malign influence can be felt, and the music helps us feel it. We are enveloped from the moment the main title opens, and ominous tread in the bass over a repeated note, string and woodwind figurations writhing in quasi-impressionistic mists, a horn summons. Then, as the credits come up over a series of dissolves from one dreamlike distorted view of the Manderley estate to another, the Rebecca theme is heard for the first time. Joan Fontaine's open narration begins, last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again. Romantic impressionist music creates a dreamlike aura as the camera tracks forward up the deserted, overgrown drive on which nature has encroached in her stealthy, insidious way with long, tenacious fingers.
The score to Rebecca. What else? What else will we hear tomorrow on Film Score Friday?
Kyle, just Rebecca. No, I'm kidding.
The whole suite.
Yes. We're going to hear The Cider House Rules.
I love that movie.
Me too. The Addams Family, Carlito's Way, Black Beauty, Danny Elfman, The English Patient, Rio Grande, John Wayne.
I just saw that like 3 days ago.
Really?
Yeah, just watch it again.
And Hook. And Hook, to me, is kind of a hook into Christmas because it came out at Christmas time. And so when I think of it, it reminds me of Christmas. And we will be getting to those holiday films soon.
Very soon, I would imagine.
I know.
Peach, thanks as always.
Thanks, Kyle.
Film Score Friday tomorrow, 10 to noon on KUAF. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Jody Benasca. She is the Vice President of Communications at Walton Arts Center. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's the holidays, and hopefully everybody is doing better than I am at their holiday shopping, because I'm pretty much delinquent when it comes to that. But we, starting tonight, we kick off a whole host of shows that sort of run us right up to the week of Christmas. Tonight we have Kathy Mattea performing Songs and the Season. And of course, Kathy Mattea is, Grammy Award winning country music voice. And she has a lot of beloved holiday and Christmas music that she performs. She actually won a Grammy for her last Christmas album. And so I think, this one will be a nice, if you like country, and you like Kathy, this will be a wonderful Christmas show.
Is it all holiday music, or is she doing some of her hits? Do you know?
I'm actually not certain, but I do know that the way she describes it is it's both that it kind of connects to the spiritual and the sort of classic family tradition that Christmas inspires in everyone. So I'm not certain whether she'll perform some of her non-holiday classics, but hopefully. Maybe she will. We could always ask her.
King Singers are approaching as well.
Yes, the King Singers. I just saw a quote about them calling them, saying that they have voices of spun gold, which is what a great image. A cappella, one of the sort of purest musical forms, I think, just voices singing these songs. And actually, Christmas carols and holiday songs lend themselves beautifully to that kind of music. And so the King Singers are probably the best of the best when it comes to a cappella. And the nice thing about their concert is that it will be, full of the holiday, classics that but being sung by these world-class vocalists. I'm really looking forward to that. I mean, the King Singers have performed for royalty. They've performed for presidents. They've performed all over the world, and now they're performing for us, which is kind of nice.
Tomorrow night.
That one is at 8 p.m. Kathy Mattea is at 7 p.m.
Kathy Mattea tonight, King Singers tomorrow night.
That's correct. Also tomorrow night, Theater Squared kicks off their second show of the season. This show, which I'm sure everybody has heard about, it's called Every Christmas Story Ever Told, parentheses, and then some. We're all very excited about it. It just looks like a really madcap, crazy romp. A couple of the actors who are in it were in the complete works of William Shakespeare a couple years back, and then another young man who everyone has seen at the university will be performing in it.
Now, big show coming up.
That's right.
Young
Big
Frankenstein.
Show. Young Frankenstein. Before we get there, though, I just realized there's one more I got to tell you about. Actually, on Saturday, so we go Thursday, Friday, Saturday. On Saturday, we have two performances by The Second City.
Oh, that's right.
That's right, out of Chicago. And we love The Second City. They come, you know, they come back here every year or so. But this year, we have The Second City's Dysfunctional Holiday Review, which... If you ever have dysfunctional holidays, you should probably go see it. So there's two performances of Second City. There's one at 6 o'clock, and then we have a late night at 9 o'clock. So if you want to avoid the crazy crowds, you know, go have dinner at 7 or so on Dixon Street and then come down and see the show at 9.
Now can we talk
now
about
we can talk about Young Frankenstein.
Yes.
So Young Frankenstein begins next week. It begins on Tuesday the 14th and runs through the 19th. 8 performances. So there's a Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday, Friday, 2 shows on Saturday, 2 shows on Sunday. And of course, you know, Young Frankenstein is based on the classic Mel Brooks film. Well, the way I haven't seen it, but the way I've heard it described is that it's this big, glittery, glitzy, ditzy, wonderful Broadway show, and the grand tradition of Mel Brooks, which basically means there's going to be amazing costumes and really zany humor and all those tunes that everybody knows and loves, Putting on the Ritz and He Was My Girl, My Boyfriend, and it's going to be great.
Mel Brooks told Kevin Kinder of the Morning News in an interview that we're going to hear tomorrow on Ozarks at Large.
Wow.
He thinks Young Frankenstein is a better production, a better musical than The Producers.
Really?
He said he honestly thinks that. But he thinks that once he won all the awards for The Producers, There was no way he was going to get...
He was never going to top that.
Yeah.
Well,
he thinks it's better.
I've heard nothing but great things about this show. I've heard that in addition to the fact that it's just funny, it's also a really well-done show. Everything from the special effects to the music to the casting, you know, I haven't heard anybody ever say, it was okay. I haven't heard that. I've heard, oh yeah, this was terrific. So it's going to be fun. I think it's a little bit off kilter. So it's, you know, not exactly your traditional holiday fare, but we'll turn it into that. Well, monsters and zombies and all that are great at the Christmas season, right?
Exactly. And anything else?
Well, on Friday morning at 9 o'clock, we have a very exciting thing happening. We're going to be putting a concert on sale that we're doing in partnership with the University of Arkansas and Live Nation. Mm-hmm. And this is a new thing for Walton Arts Center and for the university to do this together. And this is a country superstar. His name is Jason Aldean. He'll be performing with Eric Church, who also actually performed at the Arts Center last year. And they'll be doing a concert in Barnhill Arena. And Walton Arts Center has been working with Live Nation and working with the university to put this together and sort of get it going. The tickets that are being sold will be sold through the Walton Arts Center box office. And it goes on to the general public at 9 a.m. on Friday. And so we're anticipating that it's going to be a pretty big deal. Jason Aldean is one of the hottest young country acts out there right now. So that's one that you might want to get your tickets early for if you're into it.
So you can buy them online beginning at 9?
That's correct. You can buy them online at waltonartscenter.org. Or you can also call 443-5600, and the box office will be open.
So you can go and talk and look at a person and
Absolutely.
Buy the ticket from them as well.
You most certainly can. So I think it's going to be a busy morning tomorrow. But I also think it's very, very exciting because it's one of the things that we've been working hard at with the Walton Arts Center is to, you know, work more closely with the university and try to help bring more concerts into those spaces, the Barnhill Arenas and the Bud Walton Arenas, to really up the level of music and concerts that we have here. And so it's pretty exciting to have gotten this first one going, especially involving a big group like Live Nation, because hopefully it will mean that we have a better relationship and we can bring more shows here.
Yeah, there's going to be another Springsteen tour sometime.
I hope so.
I'm just saying.
I know.
Okay.
You just keep holding out for that, and we'll do our best.
Okay. Jody, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Yeah, there's going to be another Springsteen tour sometime.
I hope so.
I'm just saying.
I know.
Okay.
You just keep holding out for that, and we'll do our best.
Okay. Jody, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from Clubhouse Fitness and Health Club, offering individual and family memberships, dedicated Pilates and cycling studios, personal training and massage services. Located at 612 West Dixon Street in Fayetteville, clubhausfitness.com for more information.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and War Eagle, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 25 years. Remember, you can listen at our website, kuaf.com.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Ithi Agnihotri Mudholkar.
Thanks for listening.